everybody, welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm John Iderola, and this is a day where we get to talk about lynching because Donald Trump is a monster and we live in hell. That's not all we're gonna be talking about, but that's a bit. And throughout this video, or the show I should say, we've got Mike Pompeo revealing way too much with his silence. We've got Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is gonna be joining us to break down one important person who might be serving in the Bernie Sanders administration were he to become president. We've got Andrew Yang getting questioned about a possible third party run for some reason. And the aforementioned lynching, Ilhan Omar facing new bizarre conspiracy theories that have already been debunked, but we're gonna debunk them one more time just to be safe. A candidate will join us, and then we're gonna be doing news from around the world. And meanwhile, I try not to always have that segment be just environmental stories, but my hands were really tied in this particular case because there's environmental disasters going on around the world. So we're gonna be breaking those down to close out the show. Before that, though, let's touch base with this impeachment inquiry and Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo has been interviewed quite a bit over the past few days about what he knew and when he knew it about the Ukraine call, the cause for the impeachment inquiry. And I actually had missed a bit of video that really says a lot about where he's at in this inquiry and the Ukraine scandal. Let's take a look.
What I'm asking is, would it be appropriate to condition that?
Yeah, George, I'm not gonna get into hypotheticals and secondary things based on what someone else has said. George, you would have never done it when you were the spokesman. I'm not gonna do it here today.
Except it's not a hypothetical. We saw the chief of staff, the acting chief of staff.
It is, George. You just said, if this happened, that is by definition a hypothetical.
The chief of staff said it did.
George, you asked me if this happened. It's a hypothetical. I've told you what I observed, what I saw the process related to this very funding.
Okay, so just in case that wasn't really clear, let's zoom into the video a little bit and take a look at his response to the follow-up question from George Stephanopoulos.
The chief of staff said it did.
George, you asked me if this happened. It's a hypothetical.
What was that? He's the Secretary of State, and he looked like George Stephanopoulos was a Mack truck bearing down on him. He paused for at least 3 seconds, maybe 4 seconds. And by the way, it's not like it was a satellite connection that was on the fritz or something. He was right there, and they'd been having their little back and forth, doing just fine. He was feeling confident, he was feeling charismatic, I guess. And then when they brought that up, he's got nothing. Look at that. He has no idea what to say. I don't know if he didn't know or if he just hadn't thought through the implications of Mick Mulvaney seemingly admitting that a quid pro quo had happened. But what's even better is that as horrible of a response as that was, and it is really bad, it really does stand out historically. And by the way, the precedent that was set there, let's take a look at another video that this reminded me a lot of people of. Let's take a look at a video from a couple of years ago.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's obviously what our position is.
Now that was a terrible response, but Manafort did have one thing going for him. He talked. He didn't just like stare like dead-eyed and then like can we play the 7-second version again? Because I focus on the silence. I think a lot of people focus on the silence, but take a look at the tone of voice, the confidence with which Mike Pompeo finally responds in that shorter clip.
The chief of staff said it did.
George, you asked me if this happened. It's a hypothetical.
He said, George, like he sounded like he was about to be fired. Possibly out of a cannon, I don't know. But he was definitely scared there, and he should be because look, the video is fun and it definitely shows that he's worried about whether he's gonna be thrown under the bus, who exactly is going under which bus on this. And you never know day to day. But his messaging around this, I would argue, has been about as bad for Trump as Mick Mulvaney's actually was last week. So he was on CNBC's Closing Bell host with Wilford Frost, and Wilford Frost asked Pompeo, was the Trump-Zelensky call that you heard and the others you heard, in fact, the norm, not the exception? And that people should just accept that and get used to that's what diplomacy is like today. In response, Pompeo described a foreign leader who had called him the previous day, seeking to apply pressure to the United States to get us to act in a way that was consistent with what they were trying to do. Mike Pompeo said, it's the nature of politics, of power, of foreign interactions. Each country trying to act and deliver on for its own people. That's what sovereign leaders are hired to do, brought on board to do. Now, that is a nice sort of evasion, but Mike Pompeo understands that that is not at all what we're talking about. Yes, foreign powers will often try to get other countries to do what they want to do. That's literally what foreign policy is trying to exert your policy preferences onto another country. That is the norm, that is expected, that is 100% acceptable as long as you're not, you know, encouraging people to commit human rights violations or trying to get them to benefit you. And by you, I mean not the country, not the people, but the president. What he just described there was act and deliver on for its own people. But Trump was not trying to deliver for his own people. He was trying to deliver for his own person, him, and his desire to win re-election in 2020. And Mike Pompeo knows that. Obviously, there are some things that are acceptable to do and others that become crimes. If you accept a bag of money in return for giving a person a good or a service, you know, in a regular business, that might be totally acceptable. If you do it in return for political favors when you're in elected office, that's a bribe and it's illegal. See, the same sort of behavior, one is personal, the other is for the interests of your constituents or whatever. That's an important distinction. And Mike Pompeo there seems to be trying to pretend that that's what was going on and to say that what was done in this case is done all the time, which is literally the last thing that Donald Trump wants out there. The idea that this is not just an isolated incident, that it's actually going on all of the time. That is not helpful to his case whatsoever. By the way, just sort of swirling around this really, really fast, I want to sort of touch on one of their arguments against this impeachment inquiry is that it's unfair and unjust because Donald Trump does not get to see his accuser. Okay, if you're going to accuse me of breaking the law and not doing things the way Mike Pompeo is describing there, I need to be able to actually come face to face with you. But the thing, the problem is, and the strategy, I guess I should say, is this focus on the whistleblower by them, by Donald Trump, by Rudy Giuliani, by Pompeo, by Graham, whatever. It is not an accident that they are focusing on the whistleblower because they don't know who it is. And they can make it seem as if all of this is coming from that one person. But it's not. We saw the transcript of the call. We know what he said. We've seen the text messages between the guy who's actually testifying today and Sondland. We've seen all of that. So I've seen that. I'm worried. I'm blowing the whistle. Donald Trump, I'm your accuser, okay? Because I see what you did, what you yourself put out. I don't need any whistleblower. I don't need any sources from inside of the administration. You're my source from inside the administration. So consider me your accuser. I could probably get some other people from inside the studio to accuse you as well. Come face to face with me. I don't care about the whistleblower. You don't actually care about the whistleblower. It's a convenient evasion for you. Let's get to the heart of what actually happened. The accusations that you sold out the country and our foreign policy for your own electoral gain. I don't need any whistleblower to make that clear. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is gonna be joining us. We'll be breaking down a couple different important stories throughout the news and getting you up to date on what's been going on so far this morning after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
does lynching mean? And a mob grabs you. They don't give you a chance to defend yourself. They don't tell you what happened to you. They just destroy you. That's exactly what's going on in the United States House of Representatives right now.
So that is Senator Lindsey Graham describing what a lynching actually is, which might have led you to believe that he would be denouncing the president for comparing the impeachment inquiry to a lynching. But instead, no, he went beyond what Trump said and said it's a lynching in every way, in every sense. If you missed the tweet, I envy you, but I'm going to correct that situation for you. Trump had tweeted this morning, all Republicans must remember what they are witnessing here, a lynching. Again, the constitutional power of impeachment and inquiry going on right now, 100% legal. It is, in fact, a lynching. And joining us now to comment, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ. Emma, how's it going?
It's going great. Those comments were absolutely infuriating this morning. And the defenses by Jim Jordan and Lindsey Graham were even more infuriating, if possible.
Well, hold on. I didn't see the Jim Jordan defense. Can you tell us about that?
Basically the same thing. There's not much to add. He just tried to defend the president, and he just talked about how the president was frustrated, as if that justifies comparing what happened largely to Black Americans at the latter part of the 19th century through the civil rights movement through the 20th century, where over 3,000 Black Americans, mostly they were about 75% of the lynchings that happened, and often the white lynchings that happened were if they helped Black Americans. So it was always racially charged. Comparing it to that, where Black Americans, their flesh and bones were taken as souvenirs by the people who lynched them, where they were hung from trees, where they were burned to death for crimes that they may have not even committed, imagined crimes by racists in the South. Comparing that to what he's doing or what's happening to him, the impeachment proceedings for crimes he's basically admitted to is beyond disgusting. And the full-throated defense of Lindsey Graham and people like Jim Jordan is really just the cherry on top of the horror.
And so we did a live video about this earlier, and Edwin reminded me that the last official lynching was in the early 80s, although since then there have been a number of hate crimes that are indistinguishable in any meaningful moral sense from lynchings, including the late 80s and even earlier, even more recent than that. And I saw a story, the New York Times, I did a story yesterday on how they have once again replaced the sign memorializing Emmett Till, except that this one is bulletproof, and it needs to be because racists keep shooting holes into it. Because while there might be fewer people who are willing to actually do a lynching in this country, there are still a lot of people that look back on that time and think, man, those really were the days when we could just do this out in the open, in front of everyone. Law enforcement wouldn't do anything, the judges wouldn't do anything. It didn't matter, we could just do what we want. And that's who he's playing to right now. That we haven't even moved past the actual lynchings. We've never had an actual accounting as a country, a moral accounting for what happened. And already conservatives are taking it as like it's their defense now. They're the ones being lynched when their crimes are being investigated. So very frustrating, as you said earlier.
Well, it's the reclaiming of the actual horrors. I keep using that word, but that's what they were. And the trekking through mud, figuratively, of the civil rights movement for their own political ends. I mean, it's done all the time. Ronald Reagan started it by starting Martin Luther King Jr. Day, basically to appease people who were calling him a racist, and then claiming that he was, one of their own or part of the conservative movement. Other conservatives have done that recently. Yeah. And everything that Martin Luther King Jr. Was opposed to the conservative movement. He was a Bernie Sanders type civil rights leader, and we all should remember that, but conservatives continue to claim the civil rights movement as their own, and it's despicable. And this is Trump doing similar things in that vein.
Yeah, well, look, as frustrating as that is, there is other news that I want you to be able to comment on. So let's switch things up. Andrew Yang was recently asked, you can see this headline. He was asked about a potential third party run if he's not the Democratic nominee. And he responded by saying, yes, I would never do anything that would increase the chances of Donald Trump becoming president. The goal is to beat that man, get him out of the Oval Office. I genuinely believe I'm the strongest candidate to defeat Trump in the general election, but if I'm not the nominee, I would 100% support whoever that nominee is. And I was actually frustrated by not his answer, his answer's great, but by the question, because he has never once even hinted at a third party run. He's repeatedly said he wouldn't do that. And yet, like, of the little coverage that he gets, it has to be like, are you gonna betray us? Are you gonna try to get Donald Trump reelected? I don't know, what do you think about that?
No, it's despicable. It's once again the media trying to demonize the candidates who are non-traditional. I mean, I'm no fan of Tulsi Gabbard, but the criticism of her and trying to say that she's a Russian asset and that she's going to mount a third party run as well, I mean, that's a little more likely than Andrew Yang, who has never once given any indication that he would be a third party candidate. He's been a Democrat through and through, and just because he isn't an official congressman or an esteemed senator, and that he's an outsider candidate who's running on a different set of ideas, this is what they're trying to pigeonhole him as. The Bernie Sanders coverage, mainstream media coverage, is terrible, but this time around, it might even be worse for someone like Andrew Yang, and I understand the frustration of his supporters.
Yeah, and once the Hillary feud dies down, Tulsi will probably get the same sorts of questions that Andrew Yang just did. But she has been asked about third party runs in the past, and she has very clearly said that she would not ever do that. Now, hypothetically, she could flip on that, but she's been very clear that she's not gonna do that. And so if people are trying to attack her by saying that's her plan, she has been incredibly clear about it in the past. And look, she was obviously a huge supporter of Bernie Sanders in 2016, but like Bernie Sanders in the general election, she supported Hillary Clinton. Like, that is a level of loyalty that is just silenced and cast into the shadows when people are trying to pitch her as a threat to the process now. She's running, which she's allowed to do in a primary, and if she doesn't succeed, there's every reason to believe that she's gonna support whoever the nominee is. And so Andrew Yang is being like very game, and like he's giving good responses to this, but if I were him, I would be very frustrated about this being the limit of the media's attention on his candidacy, especially when he has, I may not agree with his plans necessarily, but he has a lot of interesting plans that other people are not talking about.
Absolutely, and then we talk about the smug reaction to the freedom dividend, which, by the way, is like pretty good idea. And just the general grossness. I mean, Kamala Harris legitimately laughed at him at one point during the debate. So I think we're seeing the culmination of the establishment candidates and the establishment press looking and how they view Andrew Yang. And I think it only helps him with his supporters, because outsider status is actually pretty popular when you talk to the general public.
That is true. Okay, let's switch to one last topic that I have a feeling you're probably going to have an opinion on. Bernie Sanders and AOC are now that she has endorsed him, being asked questions sort of the two of them. And Sanders was asked in a joint interview with CBS News if he would consider Ocasio-Cortez to be his running mate. The congresswoman answered for him as both laughed, saying, I think I'm too young for that, to which Sanders added, there you go, she's answered. But when Ocasio-Cortez was asked if she'd work in Sanders' administration, should he be elected, he interjected with a forceful, yes, you would. Which is a very Bernie sort of thing to do. But what do you think about that?
The media says.
What's that?
As in the media, next headline, mansplaining. He mansplains exactly. Ocasio-Cortez.
I have a feeling she was probably okay with it. So look, it's not very clear from that whether he means working with his administration, like in Congress, or working for his administration. But I'm just curious, what are some scenarios that to you seem likely about if he becomes president, how that relationship might proceed?
I don't think it's very likely that she'll be an official part of the administration. I think she's very happy representing New York 14. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be a stepping stone eventually for her to run for Senate, which would be unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I think that she would be an unofficial part of his administration, consulting on. I mean, I can't even believe I'm imagining this wonderful fantasy, I guess. Hopefully it comes true. But I mean, I think she would be consulting on policy, basically be an unofficial surrogate for the administration, someone who could be a large voice in Congress for the Sanders administration.
Emma, everything that you said there is logical, and I largely agree with you, but that's not fun. No, you have to pick one job. What job is she filling in the administration, Emma?
Okay, all right.
There is a correct answer, by the way.
I know that's correct, but you want to speculate and have fun.
Obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I've loved the fact that she's spoken out on Israel and the Palestinian occupation. I'd be pretty psyched if she was Secretary of State.
Okay.
I'm trying to give her the most powerful position imaginable.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
And that's the one that I would choose.
That's funny. I mean, look, she would obviously be great in it, but that's not one of the ones that I would chose at the top. I think I want her to work for the EPA ideally, but she doesn't have the science background.
You're right.
Necessarily.
That's the better answer because that's the right fit.
I think Dave Weigel tweeted to me that she's going to run the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which actually, considering some of her plans she's put out recently, I think she'd do a great job in.
Totally. I mean, she's been for rent control and all of that. Mm-hmm. So that would be an excellent fit too. But again, like no one cares about HUD and the media. So that would, maybe they would then, because the media is obsessed with her. Maybe we would start focusing on housing. I know Anna would love that.
That's true. Okay, one other little micro topic. I apologize, we're gonna go slightly over. Ever since AOC endorsed Bernie Sanders, and to a lesser extent, but similarly Ilhan Omar, I'm sure you've seen this sort of response both informally on social media and also in questions. Really, Bernie Sanders? Did you know how old he is? Did you know how white he is? And so,
and a man he is.
And man. A man. Okay, my research had not turned that up, but I'm getting nods from the control room. He is. So, when asked why, as a woman of color, Ocasio-Cortez made that decision, she said, "I'm actually very excited about this partnership because it shows what we have to do in our country is that we have to come together across race, across gender, across generation." And she was asked this formally by a CBS reporter, as a woman of color, why would you support this old white guy? I think she might have used a different term than old white guy, but you get the basic idea. What do you think about these sorts of questions coming to, especially women of color who have endorsed Bernie Sanders?
No, I actually just listened to the interview. She said old white guy in this condescending, blunt way. It was offensive.
That was our joking sort of way of describing it.
No, yeah, I mean, as long as say she said it in some sort of facetious kind of, you know, tongue in cheek way, okay, maybe we could be okay with that. But it was said very seriously, mm-hmm. And I think it's offensive. I mean, look, you know, first of all, the ageism in the media about Bernie Sanders is pretty blatant. Secondly, I don't hear Simone Sanders, who used to work for Bernie Sanders and now works for the Biden campaign, being asked, why do you work for this old white guy? It seems to only apply to Bernie Sanders. Thirdly, I mean, does the media have any moment of reflection where they think, well, his policies identify with her specific experience as a young woman of color? What does that say about the Sanders policies? No. It's just identity. What does this person look like? Because they have no interest in the policies. They have interest in the horse race. So how could she possibly make this decision? And yeah. And to me, it's just baffling and it's offensive.
Yeah, and it's obviously infantilizing. It's like, yes, AOC, you, who perhaps better than anyone else in American politics understands how your values relate to policy and are an expert at explaining that to other people, you should cast aside those values, cast aside those policies, and just support someone that I find to be acceptable. Or you could, like, I would ask the CBS reporter, why do you think she endorsed him and not Biden? Was it just toss up? Was it a coin flip? I mean, she definitely wanted to endorse an old white guy. Like, obviously, it's ideological, it's based on values, it's based on policies, and it's ridiculous and insulting to imply that she's not allowed to choose based on those reasons, or that Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib aren't allowed to choose based on those reasons.
Yeah, and just real quick, later in the interview, they ask her specifically if she spoke to Elizabeth Warren, and she said yes, and then said, quote, "Elizabeth Warren is a fabulous candidate, and that Sanders Warren and herself are on the same side in the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. but she just chose Bernie Sanders because, as she said in her speech, that's her TO. That's she was a Bernie Sanders organizer in 2016. She was always born of the Sanders organizing movement, and it's the only thing that made sense for her.
Exactly. Emma Vigeland, as always, a pleasure to have you on the show. Everybody go check out Emma's work on Rebel HQ. Thanks, Emma.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a short break here. When we come back, Ilhan Omar, the target of another conspiracy theory, this time spread by a Republican state lawmaker. We'll break that down after this. The online hatred against Representative Ilhan Omar knows no bounds, and the people who spread it seem to not know what they're talking about. Take a look at the most recent attack against her spreading on social media. This time, not by a rando, but by a Republican state lawmaker. This is North Dakota State Senator Ole Larson, who posted a photo on his Facebook page falsely claiming that it depicted Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar holding a weapon at an Al-Qaeda training camp. Larson, who's a Republican, also called Omar, one of two Muslim women elected to Congress, an elected terrorist in the post comments. So again, this is not just like your racist uncle. This is your racist state lawmaker. He was elected by his people to represent them. And the way he has chosen to do that is by attacking another elected politician and trying to imply that they are a terrorist. And he doesn't just mean that metaphorically, which would be bad enough, but that she literally trained at a terrorist camp. Now, here is the horrible thing about that. I'm gonna show you the photo so that when you see it, you will know to call it out. This is the photo that has been spread around. He is not the only person by any means to do it. That literally was posted by a different person than him, saying, looks like Ilhan Omar graduated jihad school, which don't Google it, it's not a thing. Also, that photo does not at all show what it actually is. And I'm gonna give you all the details, but understand that by the time this state lawmaker had spread this image, it had been going around for literally months, being debunked all the while. It was posted with things like, Ilhan Omar said she hates guns, jihadi Omar at a training camp for terrorists. And you know what I did to see if there was something to this, to see if that's what the image actually showed? I went to school, I went to college, I went to graduate school, and you learn some advanced investigative techniques to ascertain the veracity of a claim like this. So I right clicked on the image and did search Google for this image, and do you know what came up? This, and you can see all of this debunking of that image. It took 2 seconds. It took longer for me to screenshot that and post it in a production document. You see the image, you right click on it, search Google for the image, and you'll see whether it's true or not. And in this particular case, turns out it's not very difficult to prove that it's not true. Do you know what that photo actually is, when it was actually taken? Well, it was taken at a military training facility in Mogadishu, Somalia, back in February of 1978, which was an interesting time for a couple of reasons. One was that it marked an important date, 4 years before Ilhan Omar was even born, which would make it difficult for her to be a full-grown woman being trained in terrorist tactics in that photo. That photo has been available ever since then. It was used in a publication at that time. It's been online that entire time. That woman, by the way, not Ilhan Omar, also not a terrorist. She was a woman recruit of the Somali army. This is in the actual caption of the photo, checking her automatic weapon at a military training campus back in 1978. On the right is her instructor, her military instructor, not her terrorist instructor, by the way. What's interesting too is that that was not a terrorist camp. That was a Somali military recruit, and that photo was taken during the Ogaden War while the Somali military was receiving support from the United States. So at that time, they were effectively one of our allies when it comes to that particular conflict. Regardless of what you think about the actual outcome of that conflict, that was our side at that point. And so again, if you actually cared about this, if you thought, what's a politician I hate? I hate Ted Cruz. If a photo came out of Ted Cruz being trained in some, I don't know, some Russian deep operative camp and he's holding a rocket launcher, I would search to see if it was real before I spread it. I would think, you know what? This confirms everything that I believe to be true in a way that is way too convenient. Let me do 2 seconds of research to find out if it is what I say it is. But they don't care to do that, whether it's a regular person putting this on Twitter or Facebook, or in fact a state lawmaker. They will accuse a sitting representative of our Congress of being a trained foreign-born terrorist, but not care enough to actually check it. Now, Ilhan Omar knows that it's not true because again, she wasn't even born when the photo was taken. And she tweeted, this is pure propaganda designed to stir up hate and violence coming from a GOP state rep. Facebook's unwillingness to crack down on hate speech and misinformation is not just threatening my life, but our democracy, both of those. And I care about both of those threats. Here's the thing, that photo was taken back in 1978. It's been around, it's been on the internet ever since then. If it is being posted on Facebook today or last week or last month, it was being used for one purpose, not to educate people about the Ogaden War. It's being used to attack Ilhan Omar. And if Mark Zuckerberg says that it is too much to ask for them to screen out that photo, knowing that it is only used in a false attack to incite violence against a sitting politician in the United States, I think we're allowed to have a massive problem with that. He is helping to facilitate, helping to spread misinformation that threatens the life of a woman of color in American politics. He's doing that because he makes money to do that, Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook makes money to spread this misinformation. That is why they won't fight against it. And as always, it's on us to stand with Ilhan, not on a particular policy here, but just on the continuation of her life under threat by random people, including elected Republican state lawmakers. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Joe Cox is gonna join us. He's running for Philadelphia City Council. He'll be breaking down his run after this. We're joined now on the show by Joe Cox, running as an independent for one of the seats on the Philadelphia City Council. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. I want to talk to you about, we don't generally do a lot of coverage of city council races. We do a few because I believe that local politics is really important. So I want you to start off by saying, what is it about this seat and what you feel like you could bring to Philadelphia at the city level that made you want to run for the seat? Sort of make it real for everybody about how important these seats can actually be.
Well, I'm running for city council as a progressive independent. I don't believe a lot of the things that I am saying are being voiced like I think they need to be. One thing that makes this race important, we can make history. A lot of people don't realize in Philadelphia the way the charter works. The majority party can only hold 5 seats. So an independent could take one of those other 2 seats that has been held by a Republican since the 1950s. We have a big chance to make history. I've been running for over a year. I've been to every single city council meeting. I've been to several fights and lobbying at Harrisburg, our capital. I actually biked to the Capitol with my dogs for a protected bike lane bill. I went there for fair funding for the schools, raising the renewable energy, raising the minimum wage, affordable housing, medical marijuana, actually banning bribes on legislators, mm-hmm. which I believe is one of the biggest things, the problems in America. We need to be fighting for that very strongly. But I've been a bike messenger in Philadelphia for over 7.5 years. So I've seen just how deadly our streets are. From the lack of infrastructure, the deadly potholes, to the lack of knowledge in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And Philadelphia claims to be for Vision Zero, and I'm not really seeing the action. We have 40 plus hit and runs a day in Philadelphia. We have the highest population of disabled citizens, and we have the highest population of cyclist commuters. So we need to do much better. I started a nonprofit PMA bike ride 3 years ago that helps low-income people, street citizens. I go around giving out pizza to anybody that's hungry without any questions asked. I've given out over 4,000 pizzas. Wow. We go around giving out acknowledgement and connection as people. That's another big reason why I'm running, to voice the concern. Philadelphia is the poorest big city in America. I don't believe it makes any sense to me when we've got, when you see skyscrapers and you don't see things such as trash cans,
yeah,
bathrooms. We're not looking out to people that really I think we need to be looking out for. I believe we need to be looking out for the street citizens and our workers like we do the 1%. Philadelphia offered Amazon a ton of money to come here. I believe we need to be offering people that are struggling to create a new workforce in Philadelphia, and not these people that don't need help. We offer millions of dollars to Comcast, so they don't have to pay any taxes in Philadelphia. We need to end that, and that money would go to the schools.
Yeah. So as you point out, this seat has been held by Republicans since the 50s, and this race is generating a lot of interest. In part, we know this because there's actually multiple people who are going to be running for the seat. Some of them are, like you, independents, progressives. So what do you feel about you in particular differentiates you from these others who are competing for that seat right now?
Well, one big thing is they're not actually independents. They tell you to vote for other Democrats. They are, even in the endorsements, say that they're lifelong Democrats. I'm not a Democrat. I'm actually a true independent. I believe Philadelphia needs true independent representation, somebody that's going to call out both parties. I am not taking big corporations' money, no super PACs, no corporate interests, no oil money. I am truly beholden to the people. People power. Our average donation is $33. I believe that's what we really need, is somebody that's out for the people and actually in the streets. I'm knocking on doors every single day, coming straight to people's faces. And I'm kind of tired of picking up trash everywhere I go from campaigns that have money to just people that clearly don't seem to be, don't care much if I'm picking up the trash everywhere.
Yeah. So, Joe, where can people go to find out more information? This election is in less than a month, so there's not much time. If people want to know how to support your candidacy, find out more about what you stand for, where should they go?
If you want to learn more, we just put out a new video, actually, at www.votejoecox.com. My button is 516. On social media, it's at PMA Joe number 4 Council.
Okay, Joe Cox, candidate for the seat on the Philadelphia City Council. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to take one last break here. When we come back, news from around the world and Meanwhile In. Around the world, it has been a rough week for the environment. This is Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Romania, specifically in the deep parts of its old growth forests, numerous forest workers and forest rangers have been murdered due to illegal logging. Forest ranger Liviu Pop was responding to a tip off about illegal logging when he was shot dead with a hunting rifle this week. It's believed it might have been his own rifle, that he was attacked, disarmed, and then shot with his own rifle potentially. Another was found dead in his car last month, a short distance away from an illegal logging site in Pascani Forest District. Forest ranger had suffered serious head injuries reportedly caused by an axe. Three people, including two teenagers, are suspects in the case. There have been believed to have been already 16 attacks like this just this year, and it's believed they can all be traced to this illegal logging effort. Environmental groups are really worried about the lack of what's being done to deal with this. One, Gabrielle Pawn, head of environmental group Agent Green, says, "The forest mafia has tried to kill me several times. They broke my ribs, cracked my head open, and broke my hand before I managed to escape by running. We are deeply concerned that forest rangers and activists like us are being killed while investigating illegal logging in Romania." And already that logging has, you know, had obviously a human toll, but also a toll on the forest as well and its success in those efforts. Research by Greenpeace Romania estimates that Romania is losing as much as 3 hectares of its forest total forest cover every hour as a result of degradation, illegal and legal logging, including swaths of its pristine old growth forests. These are forests that literally were developed shortly after the last ice age, and they have continued effectively in that same shape for thousands and thousands of years. But now powerful business interests who don't feel constrained by the law, by any sense of morality, are attempting to do whatever they can to take these down for their own economic benefit. Meanwhile, Brazil is suffering from a massive oil spill that has despoiled literally 2,200 kilometers of its beaches. Now, this might come to a lot of people here in the US as news, because despite the fact that this is a massive environmental catastrophe, there's virtually no talk about it whatsoever by our media Also, oddly enough, barely any talk of it by the Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, who is doing virtually nothing. Kind of gives you a little reminder of what happened when the Amazon was burning. So nobody knows at this point where the oil is actually coming from or why it keeps washing up on Brazilian beaches. Social media has been bombarded by videos of volunteers rolling up thick globs of oil and sand and putting them into plastic sacks. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro sought to blame first Venezuela, then a criminal action to scupper a major oil tender. He has repeatedly attacked environmental protection agencies as a fines industry and has yet to visit affected areas. So all of that seems like complete nonsense, and it is. He loves conspiracy theories, especially when it allows him to ignore damage that's being done to the environment. So right now there's this auction coming up next month for oil prospecting rights. And so he says that environmentalists who are worried about that oil exploitation in the future have decided to despoil thousands of miles of Brazilian beach with oil to jettison that deal. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. This is actually a reminder of the cost, the environmental cost of oil exploration, and a preview potentially of the sorts of disasters that could come if this auction goes through and more development actually happens. Now, yesterday, Bolsonaro's vice president announced that 5,000 more troops will be dispatched to help clean up the spill. But for many Brazilians, the response was too little, too late. It has been going on for weeks and weeks, and there was effectively no even acknowledge of it for quite some time. With the Amazon, now with the oil spill, if you're in Brazil and you care about the environment, you should be very worried about the approach of your government to these sorts of problems. Meanwhile, in Canada, a local artist had a free wall and decided, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna do some art. I am going to commemorate the amazing activist work of Greta Thunberg by doing a mural of her. And so they produced this. However, you might notice that this over her face, it says, this is oil country, which is hardly the message that an artist who cares about Greta Thunberg would spread. That is because someone added to the art. A CBC journalist was shooting footage of the mural on Sunday morning when a man named James Bagnell walked up with spray paint and began painting "Stop the Lies, This is Oil Country" over the teen's face. And yes, he did this in front of a video crew. He was so confident in what he was doing that he didn't care about the fact that the news was already there videotaping it. He said to the journalist, "This is Alberta. This is oil country. My father has worked in the oil industry. We don't need foreigners coming in telling us how to run our business, support our families, put food on our tables." And let me just briefly say that there are a lot of differences between the United States and Canada. But when I hear a quote like that, I think, we got some people like that too. I sort of understand where that sort of regressive thinking is coming from. Yeah, it has been oil country, and they have done quite a bit of damage in exploring that oil, as we have here in the US and around the world. And at some point, it needs to end. The fact that we've been doing something wrong for a long time is no reason to continue doing it. But try to get that through to Bagnell. He said that as soon as he saw photos of the mural, he decided to go down and deal with it. He said his father, who recently died, would have been disgusted to see the portrait of Thunberg. I don't know Bagnell. I don't know Bagnell's dad. I would assume that out of all of what we just talked about, if he was disgusted about anything, it would be that his son is spending his time, his free time, defacing art to attack a child activist around the environment. That would be my guess. He says, by the way, James Bagnell, just shut up until you have solutions. And he's not talking there to all environmentalists. He's talking specifically to Greta. And that proves to me that he has not listened to a single word that she has said, because she has said, don't listen to me, listen to the scientists. And the scientists do actually have some solutions. One of them would be stop exploiting all of the dirty fossil fuels in Alberta, as well as around the rest of the world. That would certainly be a start. But actually pursuing that is a little bit more complicated than getting some spray paint and going down to deface art. The artist, by the way, isn't actually that bothered by this. He says, after all, it is a free space and people will do what they will with it. Hopefully they can find something more productive in the future. Okay, that is unfortunately all the time we have for the show today. Thank you everybody who has tuned in. I really appreciate that. Those of you who've been watching the live videos on YouTube before this full show, thank you so much for doing that. Please continue to. We got a big week planned, lots more to get to. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.